Thank you. House Committee on Revenue for May 22nd, 2017 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for your prompt attendance. I know there are many, many other things to do today. Colleagues, I'm not sure that any of these bills are actually ready to work, but I did want to have a conversation about them. And so we're going to open two bills together because they are tangentially related. And those are House Bill 2904 and House Bill 3146. And we're going to hear then from Representative Holvey and Representative Smith, I think, about these bills. And but first, Kyle, why don't you tell us, we have some amendments. Why don't you tell us about the amendments and what they do, and then we'll hear from the members.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I'll try to hit the high points here. House Bill 2904 and 3146, so they're relating to a similar topic in some ways, or there's some crossover, I should say, with the long-term rural enterprise zone. House Bill 2904 with the Dash 2 amendment, it's probably easier to think this one is based upon the locations that can qualify as a long-term rural enterprise zone. So step one is just outside of whether a business can qualify for, and I should back up, these are a property tax exemption programs. But to qualify for the long-term rural enterprise zone is you have to have certain qualification requirements of the county to qualify for those extra benefits that's in the long-term rural enterprise zone. So the standard enterprise zone is a 3 to 5 year exemption. It's 7 to 15 in the long-term rural. So that's the extra benefit from being a long-term rural. What the change in House Bill 2904 would do is it's changing the criteria from which to qualify to. So it's adding if a county is outside of the MSAs, the metropolitan statistical areas, all the MSAs in the state, then it can qualify as a county that can contain these long-term rural enterprise zones. So that's a new additional qualification criteria. The Dash 2 technically replaces all the content of the measure, but it adds this extra, I guess, contingent requirement for a county that's outside of all the MSAs to also then get the benefit, I suppose, of being the long-term rural enterprise zone county, the lower the qualification standard. That county would have to have total property taxes imposed by all the taxing districts within the county equal to or greater than 1.3% of assessed value. So you have to be outside of all the MSAs, and then you also have to be imposing above that specified threshold. And the importance of that was, this is in the background of the SMS, it talks about by adding the MSA change, there would be four counties that currently, right now under current law, don't qualify to have a long-term rural enterprise zone within them. They would qualify with just the change in the MSA. You add the Dash 2 amendment back in there, and then those four counties no longer do qualify, but it does touch on some potential counties that may be coming out of qualification for the long-term rural enterprise zone. And I think that's what Representative Smith will be getting to. House Bill 3146, the changes are, it does touch on the long-term rural enterprise zone, but it hits a number of other wage compensation requirement incentive programs. So the enterprise zone, long-term rural, Oregon Investment Advantage, business retention, and the Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program. So all of those are making changes. They have compensation requirements equal to 150%, and that's for, this is going to be on the eligible business to qualify, and it's reducing those to 130% for areas outside of the MSAs. Mm-hmm. Now, the link between these two bills, other than just the crossover, the long-term rural enterprise zone, is the Dash A6 language in House Bill 3146, also adds that 1.3% property tax imposed requirement for the enterprise zone and the long-term rural enterprise zone changes in House Bill 3146. So again, 2904 is about the location of the enterprise zones. 3146 gets to the qualification of the eligible business. Probably clear as mud, but maybe a good place to start.
Okay. My brain is working at about 60% these days. So
no.
Trying to keep these two bills straight is a chore for me. Perhaps you can, between the two of you, you can explain what you're trying to get done and how these bills help us get there, and then why the committee ought to do it.
Right.
And can we speak to 3146 first? Because I'm not going to speak to the other one.
That would be
and
great.
I have a committee I'd like to hear that.
That'd be great.
Would that be all okay, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely, yes.
It's a good speaker, pro tem speaker.
Yeah, we've got both open, so you can talk on either one or both.
Do you want to introduce it first, or you want me just to go for what
go
I
go ahead. Do? Go ahead, yeah.
Representative Holby.
Yeah, you can fix what I get wrong, perhaps. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8, out of Lane County, and probably a surprise to many that I'm here speaking in favor of House Bill 3146, because I think historically I've voted against enterprise zones for the last decade. But given that we have enterprise zones and given that we have a statewide approach to them, Representative Smith brought House Bill 3146, which the Business and Labor Committee considered, but we sent it to this committee without recommendation, largely because we weren't comfortable with it, but thought that Representative Smith addressed an anomaly that happens in mostly rural eastern Oregon, that so far, but could happen in other places, where you have higher unemployment, for one, and two, you're also making investments in infrastructure and those sorts of things, and your wages, and then compound that perhaps with minimum wage increases. You know, it puts the rural part of Oregon at a somewhat different level than many of the metro areas, especially on the west side of the Cascades. And so in looking at the numbers and looking at the problem, the anomaly he was facing was that, you know, this infrastructure was causing this increase of construction activity, an increase in infrastructure building, which was being built up. And then once it's done, it had basically raises the basic level of the average wage in the county, which is a good thing. But at the same time, the actual base of the working folks that are, I won't say native, but are, you know, there in that county working all the time, are sort of in the same place. And you have an industry that wants to come in, and in eastern Oregon, a lot of times, I could be speaking out of turn, but from my experience, you have a lot of agricultural enterprises and, you know, food processing, those sorts of things. And so having this anomaly that jumps up the base level wage of the county then makes it harder for these food processors, because they're now 150% of perhaps a wage that's higher than it normally would be without that infrastructure development. So in looking at that, it did seem to make sense that he had something he was trying to address, but our committee didn't really like the way he was trying to address it, so we suggested lowering the percentage down, but also making sure that it was narrow enough that counties that didn't have a very large tax base, you know, shouldn't really be spending their money on tax credits or enterprise zones, in my mind. So I threw in my 2 cents worth into his bill saying, well, let's make sure that their tax rate is above a certain level before they can actually engage in this, so that they're paying for their own services as much as they can before we lower that from 150% to 130%. And so that's where we came up with the basically $13 per thousand number, and trying to limit those counties that really have a low tax base, that they just really are having trouble, you know, funding their regular services. So that was sort of a take on this to help narrow this down to counties that were in this unique position where they had a large, you know, over $13 per thousand tax base, but yet we're still faced with this anomaly of the increased wage as they were building their infrastructure, and then couldn't get the the basic manufacturing or agricultural investments into their counties. So we looked at that and thought that we should narrow it like that and allow those counties in that fit that definition to go to 130% instead of 150%. And I have a list of what those counties would actually be. I don't know if we've shared. It's not exactly evident in the bill. But it's mostly eastern Oregon counties. I think there's one, maybe two counties that are west of the Cascades that fall into this category. And it's not all of the eastern Oregon counties either. Some of them still have pretty low tax bases. So that's essentially my input into the bill. And I've felt compelled to come here. I worked with Representative Smith to try to narrow this. I think my committee probably would have sent it with recommendation had we had the amendment that's before you. I know there's a dash 8. I don't know anything about it particularly, so I'm speaking specifically to the dash 6. That's where I'm going to end my testimony, I think. I think I've kind of explained our or at least my, you know, part work on this particular bill.
And you have a committee right now.
I do, starting in a few minutes. Okay. I started it late today because we have a lighter agenda than I'm used to.
Okay. So do we, Representative Smith, why don't you go ahead and then we'll see if we can get in some questions for both of you.
You bet. First of all, for the record, my name is Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and parts of Wasco County. I also represent the Port of Morrow and the Port of Umatilla. I want to begin by thanking the good representative for his willingness to work with us on this bill. But for, I believe, his amendment, we probably would have had a piece of legislation that may not have gotten where it needs to be. I want to push pause really quick and also recognize right at the beginning the good work of Business Oregon and Mr. Art Fish, who's worked with us to help put this language together to make sure that we meet the needs of the Enterprise Zone for the Port of Morrow and for Business Oregon. Let me share with you the problem we have. Morrow County is a rural county of about 14,000 folks. The Port of Morrow, because of its strategic location, located right at I-82, I-84, where the UP and the Columbia River come together, also being at the center of the Pacific Northwest power grid, and really geographically center in the Pacific Northwest, is finding itself in a boom of a situation in which companies are coming and locating there. And Gary Neal, the general manager of the Port of Morrow, is doing everything he can to create good family wage jobs. That's the goal of the Port of Morrow. However, one of the challenges is we're having to develop infrastructure. And so when folks from outside of the region temporarily move into the county, employment data becomes skewed. And so right now, if you looked at the per capita income of Morrow County, depending upon which number you look at, it's either number 3 in the state of Oregon or number 5. And on paper, that sounds great. That looks great. But the reality is folks in Heppner and Ione and Lexington and Irrigan and Boardman, their per capita income isn't the third highest in the state of Oregon. The numbers are skewed. And so what this legislation does is it tries to address that issue by creating a new definition of who can qualify for these enterprise zones. Under House Bill 2904, but for the passage of this legislation, the Port of Morrow falls off the eligibility list and no longer would be able to use the enterprise zone as a tool for recruitment. And on 3146, again, but for this piece of legislation, the Port of Morrow, again, would no longer be eligible to manage an enterprise zone. So what we're trying to do here is figure out strategically how to meet the needs of Business Oregon to stay in line with the legislative intent of enterprise zones in the state of Oregon, and at the same time recognize that employment numbers are being skewed because of effectively construction jobs coming into the area. And that's the challenge we're trying to work at. And we don't in any way want to take away from that. We just have to acknowledge it. But when someone comes into the county and lives for 5 to 7 months and is making $120,000 to $150,000, that skews the per capita income. And that's what we're trying to address.
Great. Questions? Representative Bueller.
Thanks, Chair Barnhart. Representative Smith, I'm very supportive of the concept. I just wonder why you selected average per capita income and not median, because the average may cause problems with the skewing, as the median might be a better.
So the language you have, this gets to be very technical, and so the language we have before us has come about as a result of working with Business Oregon and their enterprise zone expert, and so you are correct on that. We're just following their lead.
Well, I think current language is also. For the record, I think current language and statute also refers to the county average.
Doesn't mean that it's the right language.
That wasn't the debate we were having, though.
Right.
Well, what better time to fix it if it's not right?
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. Of course, in this committee, the difference between mean and median is pretty important.
Yes.
In a lot of situations. That's why when we get a report on the effect of a tax proposal, you want both pieces of data because it gives you a lot of information, just those two numbers, on the way things are skewed. These bills are not ready to work today. It's not a crazy thought that we might look at that issue, but I don't know whether there's time to actually determine whether a change would make sense or not. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here. I guess two things. Number one, are we dealing with everywhere that there is construction that is incentivized by these enterprise zones, do we just kind of go with the assumption that's too bad that out-of-town construction firms come in with their own people and do the jobs and then leave? Because I would be thrilled if these high-wage construction jobs were happening in these enterprise zones and you were hiring local people to do it. So kind of that version of that just troubles me about
Mr. Co-Chair, just really quick, not to interrupt, we are thrilled to have these folks in the community. And so please, if my comments in any way were misconstrued, let me correct that. We're thrilled to have them there.
No, I'm not trying to say what you're implying. I'm saying what when I hear that, what I think is, wouldn't we rather have local folks getting hired for those high paying construction jobs rather than people?
So Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, we most definitely would love to hire those local folks to be doing these important jobs. The reality is this is very, very skilled labor who are building these facilities. And so in a county of 14,000 people, we just don't have enough electricians and welders and steam fitters and plumbers and all of the like. And so we're having to find skilled labor from throughout Oregon and the Northwest.
I might address that too. You know, it wasn't the only consideration really when we were talking about it either. It wasn't just because he was explaining an anomaly in Morrow County. When we look, another consideration is to look at rural Oregon and you look at unemployment rates. You know, rural Oregon definitely has higher unemployment rates. And so the notion is, in these particular instances where you find this, is it better to stick to the 150% and have, you know, an industry choose not to come in, whereas what Representative Smith has described to us was that 130% actually gets them there, and then you have more jobs that are at least higher than the average in a place where unemployment is also higher. There's not a lot of, it's not a perfect, criteria, but it's as close as we thought we could get, because there's a lot of different issues, not just the construction work, but I'm sure Representative Bentz in his area has some other anomalies that are sort of similar to this as well.
So let me be real clear, because I think I've kind of muddied this up a little bit. On House Bill 2.
I'm going to have to leave, if that's all right, Mr. Chair and committee member, and Representative Smith can get himself out
questions.
Of his own mud.
He can deal with the hard questions. Thank you, Representative Holvey.
Take care. Thank you, Representative. So House Bill 2904 is actually a pretty simple.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Marsh, did you have a question?
I did.
On what we were just talking about? Or?
Well, on the 1.3%.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wondered if you could explain the derivation of the 1.3% of total assessed value. Why that number?
Sure. So originally, in statute, in order for a company to qualify for an enterprise zone, they have to create good family wage jobs at 150% of the family wage. What Representative Holvey has introduced with his amendment that we think makes perfect sense is move that from 150% down to the county average annual wage, and that was part of the conversation earlier, of 130%, but then limit it to just those counties that are investing in themselves. And I can go into a little more detail in a moment. But statutorily, it's currently at 150%.
I can answer part of that question. A lot of times these things are rough and ready based on a look at the terrain. And I, in the conversations I had with Representative Holvey, I think the number $13 per thousand comes from a practical list of the counties and their tax effort. And that's where the natural break is. If you just list the numbers, that's where the natural gap is right at that number. And I'm sorry he didn't give us the names of the counties that qualify and the ones that didn't, but not every county qualifies because some counties have less than $13 per thousand in their tax effort.
So Mr. Chair, I think I can clarify a lot of this.
Let me make one other particular comment on this. I'd love to know what the 150%, where that came from, but my bet is that it's the same kind of number. It was one of these numbers that sort of people thought was a reasonable idea without having any particularly good evidence for it one way or the other. And I suspect the 130 is the same.
Mr. Chair, on that issue very quickly, back in 2005, I was actually the chair of the committee that created the Enterprise Zone. Speaker Minnis appointed me to that. The 150% literally came out of thin air. We said, we want to create good family wage jobs. What's an average family wage? Let's add 50% to that. And in a bipartisan manner, that's how we came up with that number.
And up to now, that's worked for Morrow
County. And it's worked. Yeah. That's correct. So let me share with you on House Bill 2904, if we could just focus on that just very quickly. So the Port of Morrow no longer qualifies as a long-term rural enterprise zone program recipient. In order to qualify, they have to meet three criteria. First is per capita income, and there's a definition for that per capita income. The second thing is they have to qualify for an unemployment rate. The third is that they have to have a net migration number of less than zero. What 2904 does is add simply one more criteria, and it says, adds the option that a county can meet to be eligible for the enterprise zone to be classified as a long-term rural enterprise zone, and it adds the option that any enterprise zone within a rural county is eligible to be designated as a long-term rural enterprise zone. We originally tried to put this big criteria together, and what Business Oregon came back with and said, listen, the simplest way to do this is just say that if you're a rural county, you qualify for a long-time rural enterprise zone. And a rural county, by definition, is a county outside a metropolitan statistical area as defined by the most recent federal census. 13 of Oregon's 36 counties qualify. If you agree that a rural county should qualify as a long-term rural enterprise zone, then House Bill 2904 would add Clatsop, Gillam, Hood River, Morrow, Tillamook, and Wasco counties to the definition list of rural long-term rural enterprise zone. So really what this is it adds one-fourth option to be eligible, and that is if you're in a rural county.
Do you need 2904 if you have the other bill?
Excellent question. But for 2904, the other piece of legislation is irrelevant. 2904 is the most critical piece of legislation.
Okay.
And so in order for the Port of Morrow to continue to be eligible for these programs, we need both pieces of legislation. So that's what 2904 does. It adds a fourth option that says a rural county, as defined, would make it eligible to be designated a long-term rural enterprise zone.
Okay. So we've got two different definitions. In 2904-2, line 9, page 2, there's a definition for qualified rural county, and that there's two items on that definition, that boldface. And then in the other bill, we have this thing called rural compensation county. Obviously, a different definition. Which includes the same two requirements, as far as I can tell. Kyle is going to answer the question. Please.
Mr. Chair,
Tell us why I'm confused.
No,
don't answer that question. No. Give us the right answer.
you bring up a great point that I meant to mention up front is the language in the two bills do the same thing. The end result is the same. It's just that the qualified rural county and the actual name or the term that's being used is different. And really that's reflective of just one was drafted for one bill and then it was added to another bill and it doesn't work with the same terminology. So if the committee was interested in passing both of these measures, we would work with LC to get one term, one change within that same statute that is the same and applicable to both. And that's perfectly possible to do. It's just they're drafted at different times, so each one is more appropriate, I would say, to the individual bill. But it's certainly the end result is the same. And because it's making the same change in the definition statute for the long-term rural enterprise zone, it would make more sense, too, to make sure that language is identical as well. So it just would be, there would be, if no policy change needed, it would just be a structural language adjustment. We'd have two more amendments on each of the bills to tie that together.
Is there any reason why you can't just put the things that are changed in the other bill into 2904? I mean, it looks like the relating clause works.
Mr. Chair.
And the sponsors are the same.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the reason this legislation was brought to you this way was it was recommended by Business Oregon to bring these two issues forward in separate bills.
Okay.
Yeah, originally I was just going to bring one bill and keep it very simple, but it was recommended to us that they thought that there was enough of a separation on the issue to keep them separate.
Yeah. All right.
And I just have to share with you, Mr. Chair, what you have before you here is the byproduct of Business Oregon helping us draft this legislation.
Well, and it sounds like Representative Holvey as well.
And Representative Holvey on 3146.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? And needless to say, this bill isn't ready to work for a bunch of reasons, but including the fact that we don't have the required paperwork, do we?
No.
All right. Thank you. Anything else? All right. So we'll close the work sessions on House Bill 2904 and House Bill 3146. I don't know whether Representative Huffman is going to come or not on the other one. Let's open the work session on House Bill 2740. Wait a minute. Just a moment. Are we ready to do any additional work on 2286? Is there anything new on 2286? We have a new amendment. Let's open the work session on House Bill 2286, and let's talk about that. That gives Representative Huffman a chance to get here on the other one. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2286, you have a dash 2, which conceptually the goals of the bill and the amendments haven't changed. It's just refining the language. But to refresh everybody's memory, the bill touches on three different aspects for tax credits: the transferability, certification data to the Department of Revenue, and revocation policy. And so, kind of touching on each of those conceptually, and I should say, in OLIS there is a handout called House Bill 2286-2 Summary, which is just kind of a cheat sheet for which tax credits show up in which sections. The transferability, the policy there is to take the transfer of tax credits away from policy, if you will, agencies, and just move them to the Department of Revenue. Basically, if the legislature makes a transferable tax credit, the policy agency certifies that tax credit, and then any transferring of a tax credit is handled by the Department of Revenue, because at that point it's just making sure which taxpayer can claim which credit. And currently also in the second section for the transferability, other things that are in there are taking multi-year tax credits and basically having them be sold a year at a time. So a five-year tax credit can effectively be 5 one-year tax credits so that they can be sold at the appropriate time. There is also a deadline. There's the issue of tax-exempt entities and a deadline for the transferability of those tax credits. Currently in the dash 2, it's a 2-year time period, but that's a policy decision to be made. So the large thing, the large issue is having DOR be responsible for all aspects of transferability, and then we have some other details around the technical pieces of that transferability. Just as importantly, something that is not being touched by the amendment are, for example, transfer prices. There are still a lot of outstanding issues for transferable tax credits. The idea here is just the minimal administrative issues for the Department of Revenue. The second topic, the certification data, the idea here is to just build on data that the department already gets, but they get it in a variety of formats and a variety of timelines. They want to leverage the new computer system for the certification data, and this will basically gives them authority to request the information in certain formats and at certain times so that it can be pulled into their new computer system so that there can be real-time allowance of the tax credits, if you will, so that, you know, John Doe taxpayer is allowed a credit of $1,000 when John Doe files his tax return, DOR can confirm that that tax credit is allowed. And then the third piece is revocation. Section 4 of the bill is kind of a baseline criteria for revocation or suspension of a tax credit. And that language would be applicable to all tax credits that can be revoked. A number of the tax credits have in addition to this base language, they have very specific criteria. Those criteria aren't in this general base. Those stay in the statutes for the given tax credits. It doesn't make sense to take any unique language and put it in Section 4. The idea is this is base, this applies to everything. There can also be other reasons for revocation, and those would be spelled out in the statutes. And so a lot of the work that's being done between the dash 1 and the dash 2 is just lining up all of those changes to make sure it works. The amendment has been shared with all of the state agencies listed there, and then we're hoping over the next couple of days to circle around with everybody and make sure everything works fine and confirm. We're not expecting any fiscal impact. That's part of the reason the work's being done now, to make sure it formalizes what's already being done, basically. And then on the revenue impact, the goal is a minimal or no revenue impact, and the one issue there is the transferability to make sure we're not stepping on something there about transferable tax credits. And part of that could be the applicability. In the dash 2, the applicability for the transferable piece would be for any transfers on or after 1/1/18, and then for the certification and revocation, that would just apply to all tax years. So one thing that we're keeping in mind is if and when JTAX gets up and going with respect to tax credits, there will obviously be an overlap between tax credits that may be extended and anything contained in this bill. So okay. That's just basically an update of where we are.
All right. That's a pretty short summary for a 50-some-odd page bill.
Most of the language is in sections 2 through 4. All of the other sections pertain to specific tax credits. And it's just, for the most part, adding a sentence or two that says, if you provide certification data to the Department of Revenue, you're going to do it this way, however DOR wants, basically. And then setting up the revocation and make sure that there's a tie to Section 4 for the revocation, but there may be other pieces. And so it's been a lot of work for Ledge Council to make sure all of that fits together. But all of the statutory references for each of those credits need to be included in the bill, which is why it's so long. But if you have, when you have time to look through all of the sections beginning in Section 6 and later, you'll see the same phrases just appearing in section after section, or credit after credit.
All right. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chris, I was just looking at the list, and it says rural medical practice. How often do those get transferred?
Those tax credits aren't transferable. There are only a handful of the tax credits that are transferable. So if a credit isn't transferable, it doesn't make it transferable.
Follow up. So yep. On this list, then, which are transferable, just the?
The energy credits, the biomass, the RETC, the conservation, and transportation are transferable. And those are transferable in the general sense where we're talking about there's a purchaser and so forth, seller and purchaser. The affordable housing lender's credit is transferable, but the credit itself, it's of a different nature. That credit gets transferred when loans get sold.
Right.
So the credit isn't a separate transaction. When one bank sells a loan to another bank, that credit follows the loan. To keep in line with the purpose of that tax credit, which is to keep rents low for low-income people in the particular housing projects.
I don't think we can change that.
So follow up.
Mm-hmm, please, yeah.
So am I reading your -2 summary correctly then that
right,
I haven't pulled up Section 27 yet to look at it?
Small
is it? Why is it in here if it's not affected by our transferability?
That's the certification data.
Oh.
So currently, under current practice, the Office of Rural Health sends information to the Department of Revenue. This just formalizes all that in the same place.
Yeah.
And I should say the
six lines.
The volunteer rural EMTs, okay. I've had some communication with the Office of Rural Health, and there's a question about whether or not that will be included on what information they can provide. But that's an example of where we're touching base with the agencies.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So it's 57 pages, but most pages don't have any changes, and the ones that do, it may only be 5 or 6 lines.
Correct. And well, then it gets to be the same 5 or 6 lines.
Right, over and over again.
Over and over again.
Right.
Correct.
Because we're requiring a uniform system.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said was that in many cases, what you're doing is formalizing the process they're using already anyway.
Yes, the Department of Revenue gets this information. That's where the list started with. Where do they get data from, which agencies? And they got put on this list. And that information comes to the Department of Revenue, as I understand, in different formats and in different ways. And that's used for audits and so forth. What they'd like to do is formalize that so they can basically take a chunk of data, say, from the Office of Rural Health or Fish and Wildlife, and just directly dump it into their new computer system. And so there's a real-time checking of taxpayers who are allowed a tax credit of X dollars and what they claim on their tax return.
Gotcha. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, can I follow up in the same vein as Representative Bentz? So, like fish screening devices, are those transferable, or is that just about certification?
That's just certification.
Okay, I just wanted to confirm a couple more of my question marks on that, because I believe that child care contributions is.
Child care contributions, that is a donation, so it's not transferable.
Gotcha. And then veterans home physician?
That's certification data. If I could point out, in OLIS, under there's another handout called conceptual description. Mm-hmm. And in there.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we've looked at that before.
Let's see. This was a first handout I had put together a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
And on the second or third page of that,
you say whether it's certification or transfer.
Right, they're kind of grouped. Certification required, donation credits, and so that's okay. Any section numbers in, I don't think, well, that's from a while ago, but it largely applies.
Thank you.
I think you said this, but I want to be certain. This changes the duties of the different departments somewhat. But if I understand correctly, it doesn't make any substantive changes in the tax credits themselves. Have I got that right?
Correct. That is the goal, and that's why we're confirming that the language does comport to that.
You're in the process of confirming that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So in one sense, this is a transfer of responsibility to the Department of Revenue in some situations. And for all of it, it's formalizing the flow of information that we have to have anyway, and in some cases, it does change the transferability rules a little bit, but it mostly has to do with who gets the information. Have I understood that or not?
That's correct. It's trying to take a standpoint where if we start from a clean slate and decide that the legislature, okay, we're contemplating these, we have these tax credits, and the legislature is contemplating making them transferable, what would we do? And from an administrative standpoint, you have the different policy agencies, by that I'm referring to energy, housing, fish and wildlife. They have the expertise to know if a given taxpayer meets the qualification set forth by the legislature. Mm. But the transferability is purely a tax return issue, and so that should arguably be handled by the Department of Revenue. So it does do that. Where we do inch up on some policy questions are in the transferability section.
Okay.
And so this I want to try and make this clear to the committee, is, for example, you have a five-year tax credit, and for the most part, it's sold as a five-year tax credit,
right.
An all-or-nothing kind of situation. As always seems to be the case, there's an exception just to make the conversation more complicated. And that is for conservation credits above $1 million. But so you have a five-year tax credit that can be sold. It's all in one. And there have been certain problems with the market for these five-year tax credits. What this starts to go down the path of is saying, okay, we're still going to have a five-year tax credit, but the entity that earns that tax credit can sell them off a year at a time.
Yeah. Or all 5 years.
Or all five. Okay. Or they can sell 2 years or 3 years if they can find somebody. Generally, the one-year tax credits are more marketable, because taxpayers have more certainty over what their liability will be in the upcoming year rather than 5 years down the road. So that is where a bill that is largely kind of a no fiscal, no revenue administrative issue starts to bump up against some policy issues that the committee has grappled with and struggled with for a number of years. So we just want to be careful about that.
Well, one of the big issues that we faced is actually how to accurately value those multi-year tax credits, and this neatly puts that onus on the person who owns them, if you set the language correctly.
Well, it doesn't change the pricing. So the tax credits.
Well, it would change the pricing, because if you sell a five-year tax credit all at once, there's a discount for the present value. If you sell a tax credit every December for 5 years, the discount for present value is a lot smaller each year, but you've given up the use of the money in the meantime.
That's correct. I mean, the pricing for the 1 year doesn't change. So you are correct, though, that the price for a five-year tax credit will be different from the 1 year tax credit.
Right.
And the time value of money and the discount that has been applied to those tax credits has been a source of a lot of controversy.
Well, and of course, it's not a very efficient market, and the result of that is that the discount has to be much bigger than you would get in an efficient market, and therefore the person who earned the tax credit has less use of the money than they would if we had an efficient market or a system like the one you're proposing.
That's correct. It's the price of uncertainty,
right.
If you will.
I thank you. That's a great way to describe it. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. As a member of the committee that slugged through several discussions of transferability and how oblique it is in certain cases. It seemed to be a great step forward to just have some uniform procedures, and we would note that these provide more flexibility than currently exists for many of the tax credits, with the goal, I think, of really maximizing the value of the tax credits to the holders, and therein lies the policy question.
Sure, and then ultimately it may actually reduce the size that we need to give in a tax credit to get the same bang for the buck.
We did not have that conversation. No,
I'm sure, but that's the next implication, is you get more efficient, less waste in the process, then you can use fewer dollars to get the same result. Yeah. Anything else today on this issue? Colleagues, I know you've got lots to do, but anybody who has the chance to slog through the amendment, I think it would be a great thing to do. And you're going to finish the conversation.
Didn't we just slog through it?
No, I haven't. I don't know about you, but I can't read 57 pages in that little bit of time we've had to talk about it. Maybe you can. I can't. But it would be good if, when you come back, to tell us whether or not this amendment is ready. That if members have had a chance to read through it. I don't think it's particularly onerous, given the description of how it works. The first five or six or eight sections are the key of it. Mm-hmm. All right. And when do you think you might be ready?
Hopefully by the end of the week.
Okay, so I don't need to carry this over. We'll repost for later. All right. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2286, and open a work session on House Bill 2745. And I was hoping Representative Huffman was going to be here, but I don't see him. Is that yours, Kyle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't believe he's
coming. Oh, he may not be. All right. So this bill is also not ready to work, is it?
No.
We don't. Now, what are we missing? Paperwork or the proper amendment?
I believe just the paperwork this time, Mr. Chair. We just saw the dash A3 to 2745 came in an hour before the meeting started or so.
Oh, I see. That explains why we don't have the paperwork. Okay. So why don't you talk to us about the bill and about the dash, what did you call it, dash 3?
Yeah, the A3.
Yeah.
The A3 amendment.
Yeah.
I see. I just got posted, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So I can't actually speak to the A3. I haven't had a chance to read it myself.
Well, can we hold it over till tomorrow? Does that make more sense?
I think that gives us time to try to get
it. All right. Let's hold over the work session on House Bill 2745 for tomorrow. Let's hope that Representative Huffman can come. Let's hope that if he and you think this works, we have the paperwork, and then we can get it out if we're ready. Representative, yes, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair Barnard. And I still want to know the answer to ultimately who holds the liability for this situation.
Oh.
Who holds the bond liability? I still don't have a definitive answer to that, or for that matter, any similar type transit district.
Oh, there are.
Yeah.
Oh,
ooh. City
of Bend is
here.
Oh, is here. Okay, you're here. Let's we're still open. City of Bend, please. Whoever's going to talk for City of Bend, come up and tell us about this amendment, if that's what you want to talk about. I saw a couple of others. Don't be bashful if you're here to talk from the City of Bend. Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's probably just me.
All right.
Eric Kanzler, for the record, representing both the City of Bend and the Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council. So we have the dash A3 that was just posted to OLIS earlier this morning. It's something we've had a chance to look through starting on Friday. It reads the way we would like it to, and I can describe very quickly what it does.
Okay.
So one of the things that had been happening the last time we brought this before you, I think it was May 4th, was we were still working through some additional local accountability measures. Questions had been raised about how a regional taxing entity would continue to work with local governments and local community representatives to make sure that the tax was being implemented and the services that were being offered were being offered successfully. And so the dash A3 moves in a couple concepts that we've been working on with a variety of local stakeholders. And the first is that in the instant that a permanent tax is established. And the first step that would have to happen for a permanent tax rate to be established for transit operation would be for a rate cap to be passed region-wide. And it would, you know, then there could be these zones within the region that could opt to establish taxes for operations at or less than the permanent rate. So the end of the second page, top of the third page of the dash A3 establishes and clarifies that the regional entity, in this case COIC, couldn't simply just impose a tax after a rate had been established, but the local government, the affected local governments, would have an opportunity to say yay or nay and maintain complete local control over that situation. So that's the first step. At the top of page 5, there is some basic language about what would happen should the boundaries of a zone change. That's a fairly simple clarification. Section 3, however, which is the fifth and sixth page, is primarily where the meat of the dash A3 comes in, and it sets out four different standards or four different sections to establish the accountability. The first is that in any place where a tax is levied or a bond is established, that there be a local advisory committee representative of the makeup of the communities being served to ensure that the local governments, the community, and the transit provider were all on the same page. And that would be an ongoing relationship as long as that tax mechanism remained in place. The second is that there would be adequate communication between all of the affected local governments and the board of directors of the transit provider. And the third is that there would be an annual report, which is in essence the report that COIC has to provide to the federal government in order to maintain their eligibility for federal operational transit funding. So that would be a requirement of this bill as well. The last section in here would establish a protocol whereby were there some issue needing resolution, local governments could go through a process to establish mediation with the transit provider, and that would be the primary recourse for working through any issues. And that's the extent of the dash A3.
Okay. Questions? Can you make an attempt at Representative Bueller's question about bonding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, would you mind restating the question?
Yes, sir. My concern is just where the liability tracks if there's default of the general obligation bonds.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, the obligation bonds, of course, in this case would relate to instances where COIC was interested in funding capital projects. The operational funding would come from a transit levy, so your question relates to the former. It would not in this case be any of the local governments that would hold the bond or maintain any direct responsibility. So, for example, I know one of your earlier concerns was whether the actions of one local government could put the bond rating of another local government in jeopardy. Our understanding is that that would not be the case, that it would be COIC that would hold the bonds, and that it would be its responsibility to shoulder the burden of administering it properly.
Clarification?
Yeah, please. Mm-hmm.
So still, I get that, and I appreciate that clarification, but if COIC defaults, then where's the liability end up for a general obligation bond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I would assume the liability would reside with COIC itself. It sounds to me like you're wanting a technically complete response, in which case I would have to do a little bit more research. But it would not reside with the local governments that are otherwise in the region. And part of the problem is that, well, I don't know if it's a problem so much, is that in researching the issue, we hadn't come up with any instances where a general obligation bond had been defaulted on. So while there may be a regulatory setup to establish what would happen, I don't think anybody has run that particular course.
Thank you.
That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, and I think we need to plan for these contingencies, right, or at least understand what the liability is and who holds it
ultimately?
I think that's a great question for staff. I would refer you to Section 1 of the bill, where there's a description of the bonding authority of the intergovernmental entity. And the technical answer, I think, is that it depends on the bond indenture as to who's liable for it. And most bond indentures aren't going to be approved by the green eyeshade people in New York or London unless there's a very ironclad way of making sure that some tax stream is dedicated ultimately to paying the bond. Now, we can get additional information, but I think we should ask staff to find that for us based on the statute. And it looks like it's ORS 190.083 as amended in the bill, maybe some other statutes too. But I think this is a really great question, and obviously one of those questions that we need to have an answer to before we can go out on this limb. Okay. Representative Buehler, something else?
Nope, that was it. Yep.
That's it?
Yep.
All right. Well, obviously we're not ready to work the bill today, but I appreciate the fact that you're here and giving this explanation. Kyle, do you think you'd be ready with an answer on this tomorrow?
Definitely talk to LC and see if we can get the bond answer.
For the purpose of today, then, we'll roll over the continued work on House Bill 2745 in work session to tomorrow. And we're finished with it for today, so we'll close the work session on House Bill 2745. And Paul, I don't think I'm planning to roll over the other three because I don't think they're going to be ready tomorrow. Do you? No. So we'll repost for those. Colleagues, there's a possibility that there may be an afternoon floor session coming up, as a little birdie tells me. So at any given meeting, it may be that I sit down here by myself for 2 minutes and move everything on the agenda over to another day. So pay attention and be ready. But otherwise, expect to be here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. Do we have a meeting tomorrow morning of the Joint Committee?
Yep.
8:30 tomorrow morning, Committee of the Joint Committee right here. All right. Thank you. Anything else? No. All right. Committee's adjourned.